The first case set for 10 o'clock is Patterson versus State Department of Corrections. And I just asked the attorneys to please state their name. Oops, I think I just hit the panic button. I'd ask the attorneys to please state their name for the record for my clerk. And for appellant, may I ask, do you want any rebuttal time? And if so, how much? Thank you. Thank you. All right. You can proceed whenever you like.
May it please the court. My name is Nicole Scott on behalf of the appellant Dante Patterson. Mr. Patterson asked this court to reverse the district court orders denying his motions for a new trial and denying his request for injunctive relief. This case is about whether courts have the ability to appoint counsel for an indigent incarcerated plaintiff with a mental disability that is forced to proceed to a damages trial where the court already found the state had repeatedly violated the plaintiff's civil rights. This case also presents an issue of first impression. Whether undisputed violations of an inmate's First Amendment rights require proof of a physical injury in order to recover anything but nominal damages. A new trial is warranted for three reasons. First, Mr. Patterson was denied a fair trial. Four characteristics demonstrate this unfairness: indigent, incarcerated, pro se without any resources, mental disability. Second, the district court abused its discretion when it denied Mr. Patterson's motion for a new trial based on error of law that only nominal damages are available for First Amendment violations. Third, this case warrants a new trial because of accident or surprise. Mr. Patterson's mental illness triggered a psychiatric shutdown during the trial. For all these reasons, a new trial is warranted, not only to protect Mr. Patterson's constitutional rights, but the constitutional rights of all citizens that are incarcerated and indigent. What is more, the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Patterson's request for a permanent injunction. The district court had already granted a preliminary injunction to protect Mr. Patterson from being arbitrarily removed from his religious diet in conflict with prison guidelines.
So let me ask you, start with the injunction question first. The argument that was made below in here is that no permanent injunction is necessary because it's moot. It hasn't happened again. So here's my question for you, and it's a little bit outside the record, but I'm just curious. Since the briefing in this case, has there been any repeat of these incidents, or is it are things just going okay over there?
Thank you, Your Honor. To my knowledge, it is not repeated. But as Mr. Patterson noted, when he filed this motion for a permanent injunction, he stated that that after the incident, that there had been repeated times where he was denied his kosher diet. So considering that the district court had previously found that he was arbitrarily removed in absence of prison guidelines, he wanted to craft it in preliminary injunction prior to ensure that he would receive his kosher diet within the guidelines of the prison operating procedures. It should be able to issue a permanent injunction going forward to make sure that he could receive the kosher diet going forward.
What evidence can you point to a trial that reflects that Patterson had established pain and suffering in the form of emotional distress for which damages could have been assessed?
There are a couple of things. It is worth noting at the outset, though, that Mr. Patterson stated that he was unable to continue. He was getting too emotional. He told the court that he said, this is on page 2842 of the record, "I guess the only testimony I can offer is my own, you know, my own pain and suffering. And I apologize if I get a little emotional, and I don't know, it's hard to ask me to speak, you know, the kind of, I guess, emotional injury, pain and suffering that endured during the violation." He then referred to his damages memorandum, where he described in an affidavit how he was malnourished, he lost weight, he had physical hunger pains, and a loss of energy.
Where's that at? Is that affidavit within the record as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's
the
number on
fourth volume of the record.
I'm sorry?
Fourth volume of the record, 946. And then the pin sites are at 989.
At what?
989. Mr. Patterson also described the way that non-kosher food is processed in such a way that the animals are terrified and the meats, the flesh, is saturated with fear and adrenaline. This was against his what he held steadfast as his Judaism faith. There's no dispute in the facts. Mr. Patterson is an inmate in the correction for the Bad Department of Corrections. He came in, and as an adherent of the Judaism faith, he was on a kosher diet. The Nevada Department of Corrections, what I've been calling the state, removed him from this diet for as the district court put it, an arbitrary reason. They told Mr. Patterson he had to prove through a recognized outside organization that he was Orthodox or conservative Jew, but this was not part of the state's actual procedures. Mr. Patterson only had to demonstrate with an interview with the institutional chaplain that he had a substantial philosophical understanding of the religion and its dietary practices. Mr. Patterson was denied this interview. He filed a complaint in White Pine County, also moved for a preliminary injunction, and he also requested counsel.
Is there any error that in this case, you know, it seemed like at the trial, the judge was very intent with punitive damage, I say intent, asking the Attorney General questions regarding the prison's like bad intent. But here, would you argue that there was a conscience indifference to his constitutional rights or First Amendment to receive the kosher food based on from the one memorandum that abruptly stopped his kosher food?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In Smith v. Wade, the United States Supreme Court said that punitive damages, neither for Section 1983 actions, can be assessed when the defendant's conduct is shown to be motivated by evil motive or intent, or when it involves reckless or callous indifference to the federally protected rights of others. Here, the district court had already found that the Department of Corrections arbitrarily removed him from his diet for 356 days. That's 1,068 meals without ever having his kosher diet. That's every time he's sitting down to have a meal and have a prayer prior to his meal. He knows he's about to ingest food that is not within his religious guidelines. And that explains why he said that he felt loss of energy, malnourished. It pained him emotionally. And the district court even agreed that the district court said, I can see that you have suffering. I can see that it affected you. For those reasons, punitive damages should be at least considered when there is this arbitrary guideline that's been completely ignored and removing Mr. Patterson from a kosher diet.
Well, he had the chance, though, didn't he? He won at the pretrial stage, an inmate winning a preliminary injunction and a summary judgment against the state. I've never heard of that before. So he was very successful in the pretrial stage. He asked for a trial for damages. He had his opportunity at the trial, but he didn't actually present the evidence to establish the damages. And when he finally said, I'll rely upon my briefing, he didn't actually offer his affidavit into evidence. So the state, what's the state supposed to do? So now we're talking about something that was used at the pretrial stage, attempting to use it at the trial stage when it wasn't actually offered into evidence.
A couple points to that, Your Honor. First, Mr. Patterson lacked resources completely. Mr. Patterson described the law library not having the materials that he needed. He did not have, for example, any rules of evidence.
He had the NRS, though, and it's in the NRS, the rules of evidence. So that was a little misleading, I thought.
Noted, but I would argue that Mr. Patterson also has a mental disability. He described in both of his motions for relief following the trial that he had a psychological breakdown. It's one thing to write a paper and do research and do everything to prepare and have that time. But a person with a mental disability, such as schizophrenia, experiences stress at a level that is more expansive than what we experience as an average person. So In addition to that, Mr. Patterson did not have any resources to conduct any discovery. He couldn't depose any witnesses. He couldn't, his motions for having depositions were quashed because he couldn't afford recording of a deposition.
Well, let me ask you this. So here's an argument that the state could make. Okay, he already won on liability. All that's left to trial is damages. And the nature of the damages you're seeking are kind of, aren't they uniquely what's going on with him? Whose deposition of someone else is he going to need to prove his own damages? So the argument could be here, he won in part, the liability part, in which he really needed a lawyer, but he won anyway. On the part that's left, it's purely factual. What happened to you? What's your harm? What discovery does he even need for that?
There is discovery that is needed. An expert can distinguish as there have been, experts are used all the time for discovery to show damages that are available. But additionally, the district court was confused because it relied on inappropriate case law to suggest that he wasn't entitled to anything but nominal damages. That's not the case.
The district court may have been wrong on that, but didn't the court correct that in its post-trial order?
Go ahead and finish. You're at 5 minutes.
The district court still relied on the Oliver v. Keller decision to say that it did not warrant anything but nominal damages.
Right, but the district court made a finding that no damages of any type were proven.
Your Honor, I would like to address that when I come back on rebuttal, but briefly I would like to say that the district court, the order contradicts what was actually found during the testimony. During the transcript, the district court admitted that Mr. Patterson, he said, I can see you suffering. I could see it affected you. How can you not let that part get into the finding in the actual findings of the record, findings in the order?
Well, we'll let the AG answer that because that was going to be probably my first question. So thank you. And we'll put you right there on the spot.
Well, at least I had an extra couple seconds.
How do you reconcile that? Because in the transcript, it's very clear that the district court judge did believe that he suffered emotional distress, and yet you slid that AG order in there and you signed off on it, and it says none. But yet it does contradict what the district court stated at the conclusion of the trial.
Well, Your Honor, first off, at the trial, I mean, obviously, while the Attorney General's office did draft the order, at the trial was when the court made the determination of the $1 in nominal damages, so it didn't change it in that respect. And at the trial, the district court also went into a long soliloquy talking about the fact that he believes the state of the law in the Ninth Circuit is you don't have to show physical injury.
You're still with the fact that the Oliver case would be on point in a case like this, despite the footnote within Oliver that says that this has nothing to do with First Amendment violations?
Maybe I misspoke. What I was trying to say was I believe the transcript is clear that the district court said that he did not have to prove physical injury at trial. And so I think that it was clear that the district court was, at the time of trial, in determining whether or not damage is there, considering whether or not emotional or mental injuries could also provide him with damages. I would say that I do think that while the court said that it's clear that something has affected someone, you still have to have some sort of objective component to establish injuries. I can say that I have a broken arm and it hurts, and it's clear that it hurt. I mean, no one's going to dispute that I say that it hurts. Any of the members of the court could also have a broken arm. But as Judge Tao indicated, those are personal to each person. There's no way for me to really be able to articulate how much pain I'm in.
That's in any case, though. In every case, a jury decides on a vehicle accident or anything else what the pain and suffering is. And that's abstract, and they're throwing it out there. And, of course, in settlement conferences, that's always the big unknown, right? What is a jury, and how do they gauge it and everything else?
Right.
The judge had the same responsibility here.
Well, that's absolutely true, especially at the pain and suffering stage. But another component of a lot of compensable injury claims, especially when somebody who's not incarcerated, is medical bills associated with their damage, with their injury.
Going into the medical bills, how is an inmate, in any case, let alone this case, if you won't give them their medical records to even inspect, how are they to prove physical damage, like in this case? Because he could have shown maybe, perhaps, and I don't know, because we don't have that, he didn't eat the kosher, he would not eat the food because it wasn't kosher, so he may have lost a significant amount of weight. That has damage to the organ. I mean, I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there. But I'm looking at the broad spectrum of all inmates. How do they, if they can prove a constitutional violation, they can't get their hands on medical records to show physical injury.
Well, Your Honor, I need to push back on that assertion by plaintiff a little bit. They're not allowed to have their medical records in their cell. This has been a long-standing position of NDOC that the court is aware of.
So where in the record does it show that you let him inspect the medical records or you offered it to him? Because it appears from his testimony that he was never given that opportunity.
When we provided, I believe it was the responsive brief to the damages component, there was medical records attached under seal, and in that briefing, it indicated that they would be available at the warden's office and he could type to review them.
Wait. So it's under seal. You file it with the district court. How does the inmate have access to inspect those records if it's sealed with the court?
Because in that filing, it indicates that a copy of them were being provided to the warden's office and that Mr. Patterson could type them by seeking to review them in the warden's office. If you give me one moment, I can find the page.
I'd like that.
It's going to be in the 2240 range, and the briefing, we talk about the exhibits there, and on page 5, 2244, it's page 5 of the actual document.
Wait, say that one more time, sorry.
It is the document that's entitled Defendant's Response, Plaintiff's Memorandum of Points and Authorities in Support of Plaintiff's Claim for Damages.
Can you give me the appendix on it?
It starts at page 2240, Your Honor. And on page 5, we talk about the exhibits that are being provided under seal, and it indicates that those documents at somewhere in this will be provided for Mr. Patterson's review in the district or at the warden's office by kiting them. And Mr. Patterson is aware of, and Mr. Patterson even suggested that he did review medical records for an hour. He says that it was in a companion case, a retaliation case. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Patterson is clearly aware that there's opportunity.
Where did he
to
say that?
Medical records. He said that in his post-judgment motion when he was seeking counsel yet again. He said that actually at trial, that he had an hour to review medical records. He said that and the transcript is found.
Is that where he says that, I had it a week before trial, an hour to look at them?
It is at page 2844, when he asked that the medical records be stricken, he talks about the fact that he reviewed them for an hour. Now, we can argue whether or not an hour was sufficient, but what we don't have is any indication whether he ever asked the district court, I need more time to see these. They haven't given me enough time. And what we also know is that the district court took approximately a two-hour recess. I believe it was a little longer than a two-hour recess to allow Mr. Patterson to review the court's file for any documents that he wanted to put into evidence to use in his case, and if there was any documents that he needed. And at that point in time, Mr. Patterson said he was worried about grievances and worried about the unabridged version of the case notes. He didn't even say anything about medical records, but the court let him see the entire file. So I think that it is very clear here that Mr. Patterson had access to the medical records the same way all inmates are provided access to their medical records in these types of cases, and that he had an opportunity to review them by kiting pursuant to NDOC policy. Judge Gibbons, it looks like
you mentioned that the state asked to submitted copies and Patterson asked to strike them.
Yes.
Does that imply the medical records were unfavorable to him?
I would make that leap, obviously, if he's asking that they be stricken. And in that respect, if we look at the actual document that I just referenced a minute ago in response to the memorandum, if we look at that document, it actually discusses some of those documents. And it says, regarding those documents, it points out that he went to the doctor at least five occasions in 2010, February 2nd, August 3rd, August 18th, September 15th, and September 26th, and that's at 2244 of the record. And on each of those occasions, he never complained about weight loss. He never said that he was losing weight or that it was a medical illness. And frankly, and there's also a kite in his mental health records. This is also at the same page as the record, 2244, where he says that he's gaining weight despite the fact that
he's not getting his kosher meal.
Not eating.
So let me throw this one then at you, since the last one didn't work. Let me ask you this. Because I'm looking at the broader picture, not just this inmate, but sure. All inmates. When there is a constitutional violation, especially the First Amendment, historically there's going to be very little physical injury. It's generally going to be, especially a violation of somebody's religious freedom. How do you reconcile the fact that, let me give you a hypothetical. For example, if an inmate breaks their finger, they could get a physical injury, right, medicals, and also perhaps some pain and suffering. But here, just like in any perhaps constitutional violation, and that was found here with summary judgment, how do you reconcile the nominal damage and say, well, you can, how do you reconcile the fact that you're not going to have physical injury and that it's not compensable for emotional distress, for violation of constitutional rights?
And punitives.
Punitives for that matter, too. I agree.
Well, I think that is one thing. I'll start with the punitives. They can obviously get punitive damages if they're showing that this is an intentional behavior under 1983 and they're bringing a 1983 claim. They're entitled to punitive damages.
This is more of a conscience indifference. I think we can all agree that the policy was just changed. He had a kosher diet and suddenly, he gets a memorandum. He didn't get his kosher diet for a year and then he gets his kosher diet when he petitions the court.
Well, Your Honor, if I could. A little bit of indulgence and a little bit of this will be outside the record. Judge Howard asked about where he is currently. The reason why the policy was changed, it wasn't changed specifically for him. It was changed for all inmates, and that was because there was a mad dash of inmates wanting to switch to the kosher diet. So that was and that's been mentioned.
Who can blame them, quite frankly?
Well, certainly. But we didn't single Mr. Patterson out. It was trying to get a grasp on the fiscal concerns that this was putting on the prison. And that's been hashed out in other cases, as the court's aware, so I won't focus more time on that. But I think that's the point here. There wasn't anything about Mr. Patterson that we were singling him out to punish. We were trying to make sure that there were sincerely held religious beliefs for people who needed a kosher meal. And so they asked that they get a letter from a rabbi that says, you need this meal. So it was a change of policy. Yes, there was some procedural issues with the way that went about, and that's one of the reasons why we're here, for sure. But I think that shows why there wasn't malice here. This wasn't an evil intent. Mr. Patterson wasn't being singled out because for anything that he did. If I can now circle back to your other question about First Amendment issues where you generally don't have a physical injury, I would first say that I think that the PLRA, that it's a congressional decision. And the PLRA, at the plain language of it, which is why the majority rule is what it is, says that you don't get them unless there's an accompanying physical injury. And I could make the analogy of, in the context of just general tort, because tort for intentional infliction of emotional distress or negligent infliction of emotional distress. Sometimes the courts require a component of a physical injury associated with those torts. So even though there was an emotional injury associated, you still have to accompany that by a physical injury. So it's not unique in the context of a constitutional tort that you sometimes have to show a physical injury even when you've had an emotional distraught situation. And again, I'm not trying to, no way, shape, or form do I ever want to change places with Mr. Patterson, and I know that nobody would like to, but again, you can still get compensable injuries if you show medical bills and show that you have costs associated with those things. The records that were provided to the court in that exhibit that Mr. Patterson presumably had an opportunity to review during that 2 hours of recess showed that he didn't complain about these things to his psychiatrist.
So let me ask you about the appointment of counsel issue here. Now, a lot of, you know, again, we're looking not just at this case but at other cases, and you made the argument that some of the stuff that's true of him, you know, no, his prison library is very limited. He can't serve discovery. That's true of all inmates. But the one thing here that's pretty unique to this case is this guy's apparently having a nervous or mental breakdown during trial, which, as you know, doesn't happen all that often. Why doesn't that distinguish this from the run-of-the-mill case where, yeah, your prison library sucks and you're complaining about it? Why isn't that enough to trigger appointment of counsel?
Well, a couple things, John. First off, and we have a transcript, and we said, and I think my learned counsel on the other side even said this, he says, I'm too emotional to continue. So from the transcript, whether that's a mental breakdown or somebody's too emotional, I think is really difficult for this court as a reviewing court to determine. We know that the district court judge had him in front of him, saw him, and also had
he also said wow after his testimony. He's like, wow.
He did say wow.
You can kind of, that kind of speaks some volumes out. He says wow.
Well, it could also speak volume. I mean, yes, it could, but who knows what the wow meant. It could go either way, correct, right? I mean, he might be surprised that after 6 years and telling him he needs to show damages that Mr. Patterson didn't do anything to show damages. It could, you know, there could be numerous reasons why the wow was uttered.
It didn't appear that. I mean, very rarely can you kind of get from a transcript where the judge is at, and it did appear that there was something emotional going on based on the transcript.
And I'm not going to say that something emotional didn't occur. People can get emotional in trials. Lawyers can get emotional in trials. And again, I'm not trying to downplay that, but I still think that's a giant leap to say that because somebody's emotional, that reaches the level of incompetency or incapacity that they need to have an attorney.
Let me ask you also with that, and I know you weren't the counsel there, and because and so this isn't directed toward you as the attorney general, it's a different attorney general. But without counting, there's probably 100 objections to everything, every question he makes. On the one hand, the attorney general says, look, he doesn't need counsel, no appointment of counsel. Yet you got an attorney general, not yourself, objecting to compound questions. Compound. I mean, we've all been prosecutors here. Okay, who does that? Seriously, just let him talk. Let him get his, when does he have access to the court if you can't let him talk? And I get that we all have to adhere to the rules of evidence, but it seems a little disingenuous, does it not, for the attorney general on the one hand to say you don't need an attorney, yet object in a proceeding over 100 times, and I'm going to probably count it.
Well, thank you for pointing out it wasn't me, and that it was other attorney generals in charge there. That's a tactical decision, and I may have made a different one. Obviously, the district court, I think, still could give leeway in those circumstances and chose the way he chose. I see that I'm out of time, but if I can have just 20 seconds to
sure.
finish a thought.
Go ahead.
Back to the point on the counsel, we have those record right there. This was nearly 3,000 pages of record. The cases went for a very long time. There is no mechanism specifically to appoint counsel. This trial was tried in June of 2015. The complaint was filed in September of 2010, so the district court also had to weigh the fact that the five-year rule was coming in quickly with regard to this trial. And as the post-judgment verdicts motions indicate, there's a letter from an attorney, a seasoned attorney, indicating that these cases are nearly impossible to win, but yet Mr. Patterson did it. He did the impossible, as Judge Gibbons noted, by getting summary judgment against our office. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Did either one of you have anything further from him before I let him sit down?
No.
All right, thank you. We'll hear from Helen again in rebuttal. Go ahead and put five on her since I think she was answering a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Several points on rebuttal. First, Mr. Patterson explained in his post-trial briefings about his mental and emotional breakdown. He told the court that he became mentally crippled in the afternoon and that he had a psychiatric shutdown and he had to defer to the record. This is, if it wasn't apparent, for which for me it was from the transcript, that Mr. Patterson was having a psychological breakdown, Mr. Patterson's own post-trial briefings demonstrate this. Moreover, the district court noted to Mr. Patterson on multiple occasions that he couldn't understand him. He said that he was rambling. This shows that Mr. Patterson was having difficulty processing his thoughts, and it was from his mental disability. The district court had narrowed this claim down to a First Amendment freedom of religion claim. It's a federal law claim, and yet federal statute that you could appoint counsel, it doesn't apply. But federal courts would have looked at this and looked at two factors, the likelihood of a success on the merits, which was already established, and then second, the complexity of the legal issues. This second factor really favors Mr. Patterson. He lacked competence to litigate. He's not educated. He had an inability to gather evidence, and he had a mental disability. As the Seventh Circuit has said, he also had to prove the state of mind, which is way too complex for a pro se plaintiff.
Ms. Scott, are you aware of any case where a person was successful in the first phase of it without counsel, and in the second phase of the proceeding, damages as a plaintiff, as an inmate, was appointed counsel?
In the state of Nevada, Your Honor?
Anywhere.
Your Honor, I'm not in a state court. However, I am familiar with, obviously, federal court proceedings.
As a plaintiff seeking damages against the state, not defending something, but affirmatively seeking damages.
There have been incidents that I cited to in my opening brief in both Nebraska and Delaware where counsel was appointed, not for a defendant, but for a plaintiff.
What about, are there any cases cited to specifically for a trial court getting reversed for failing to appoint counsel based on what we're talking about?
I would say not for failing to appoint counsel, but for failing not to consider whether to appoint counsel. The district court here on three separate occasions just bluntly denied any counsel, said, you don't get counsel. I don't care that you're pro per. We all know that. That's at 2847. If there's three different occasions where he asked for counsel, indicating his mental illness, indicating his lack of resources, indicating his inability to conduct discovery, it should be, as the Supreme Court in Nevada in Goldberg said, that the courts have inherent powers to administer justice. And in this case, the court should have looked and said, the district court already knew he had a mental illness, that he lacked resources, he couldn't conduct any discovery, which the state does not dispute, and he didn't know how to examine a witness, including proving that complex issue of state.
Just a real practical question. Who would have paid for it if counsel was appointed?
Mr. Patterson was, the district court acknowledged that, he said, I'm surprised an attorney didn't come up in here and take on this case because he would have gotten fees and costs for this. So appointing counsel should have been an opportunity for the court because an attorney could have gotten fees.
Right. The court said, all right, I'm appointing Randall Gilmer as counsel, assuming he's no longer with the Attorney General's office. Who would have paid Mr. Gilmer?
It would have come from the fees and costs that he would have won. And besides that, what else would have happened at the damages trial? You would have had competent counsel that could look at medical records for longer than an hour and determine exactly what Mr. Patterson went through.
But what if he had not won, like actually happened? Who would have paid Mr. Gilmer then if he was his counsel?
It should be within the court's discretion to appoint counsel. So
I know, but does the county pay it? Does the city pay it? Does the state pay it? What budget does it come out of? And what happens when the next inmate asks for it?
I think in extenuating circumstances, the county has that burden. There's a burden to administer justice fairly, and here it was not done so.
Okay. Well, this for way of an example, in the guardianship laws, there's a provision for the court to appoint counsel. And in the older laws, it never said who pays for it. And so when I had those cases, I would look for like a pro bono counsel, but if it was in some extreme case, I could still appoint it and say the county you pay because it's in the statute that the court can appoint counsel.
It's also within Goldberg's holding that you can administer justice, which did not happen here. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking this on pro bono basis.
We want to thank folks.
Too bad you weren't at the trial level.
Yeah, Ms. Scott, both sides did an excellent job. It's a very, very interesting issue, and I know you took this pro bono, and on behalf of the court, we thank you. And we always thank you. You're in here all the time, and as always, you do a great job. And thank you so much for being here and taking such quick questions. It's an interesting case. Thank you so much.
Mr. Gilmer, sorry to project your future as an attorney on the other side, but
it's generally right now. It generally does help.
I understand.
The case will stand submitted.